I just told Lori at the during God Night time, I said, man, I've swung at him twice and he hasn't said anything yet. Well, he's in the game now, right? I pick on Ohio State. You know where Ohio is on the map, right? They're here and then Michigan's on top. I mean, that's God's opinion. Okay. But I'm hard on Ohio because it's fun. And they have fun with us as well. But I really don't mind some things about Ohio. Everyone that has lived in Michigan knows where Sandusky, Ohio is. And we make the trip every summer down to Cedar Point. It's the roller coaster capital of the world. If you've never been there, you need to go. My sister lived in Akron, Ohio for years. She and her husband and their three sons. And I used to go down there a lot. The Cleveland Clinic has saved my mom's life. With heart surgery, and so I have a lot of fond memories about Ohio, and actually, you know, they do have a good football team. I have a question for you: if you have the Ohio State quarterback, the Ohio State running back, and the Ohio State wide receiver in a car, do you know who's driving? The cop. Yeah. Okay. Very good. You've heard that one before. But I didn't mind his sweatshirt. It's red, and I at least know where he is in the room, even without looking right at him. The color red, that the Ohio State Buckeye color red, reminds me of, I'm from the Detroit area. I grew up in the auto industry. My father had a business that it was a drafting business that designed welding fixtures for the assembly lines there. And I remember a red car that came out in the 80s that was all the rage. It was only available in three colors, actually, red, white, and black when it came out. It had two doors. Some of you may remember the Pontiac Fiero. Do you remember that? The Pontiac Fiero. And I was taking a drafting class in my high school, and we had a field trip. And we took the drafting class to the Pontiac plant, because it was just about 20 minutes from our Christian school, where they were manufacturing the Fiero. And it was actually a fascinating field trip. But I'll never forget, you know, they were trying to sell the Fiero as they took you on this tour. And they took us into one room, and I'm not an engineer, so I don't know what the Fiero was made out of, but it was made out of some plastic shelling on the outside, and it was limited to those three colors for whatever reason. And they wanted to demonstrate how indestructible the door panel was for the Fiero. And in this one particular room, they had a bowling ball attached to a long chain on a machine. And the machine would bring it back and then release it, and a bowling ball would slam into the door of a Fiero and just bounce off. And that thing happened all day long for weeks, I'm sure. And there were some markings on the side of that Fiero door, but it wouldn't crack. It wouldn't dent. And they were showing us how indestructible the Fiero was. And that lodged itself in my mind. I was pretty impressed with that. But I got to thinking, what do you do with the door when you're done? You know, it's marked up, and sure, it hasn't cracked or anything, but no one's going to want that door. I'm sure it's safe to assume that that door was discarded fairly regularly to replace it with a new door for the demonstration to keep it looking sharp. They were beating on it to prove its indestructibility. And it was a great display. But I find this in my own life. And as I have the opportunity and the joy of working with others in discipleship, I find that a lot of us Christians often feel like that Fiero door. We're constantly getting pummeled. And yeah, we're fairly resilient. We're still there after the fact, but we wonder if we're ever going to be usable. And sometimes the pummeling in our lives, we invite ourselves. Maybe we go through long seasons of reinforcing private sin habits. And sure, there are times when we want to be rid of those, only to find out that we constantly feel and keenly feel that gravity every day to return. And some of us, we've been outright difficult in relationships. And it's not just one relationship in our lives. Sooner or later, we notice a pattern with anyone that gets close to us, there's carnage in a relationship or a friendship. We go through our lives sometimes and we wonder, wow, I've brought on so much failure in my life. I've failed so often. And many times in our own failure, we eventually get upset and impatient. We blame God for our circumstances. We blame God for our relationship trouble. We can even blame God for our struggles with private sin. And then we are guilty about that, for blaming God. And a lot of times we feel like that door from that car. We wonder if we'll ever be used again. Can you relate with me? Have we gone too far? Have we fallen so low that we wonder if we'll ever be able to rise again to usefulness? Once again, I can relate to that. And that's why I love what I read about Peter in the account of the Gospels. Peter, the one who would write in 1 Peter 5:9, "Resist Satan, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world." Peter's saying, you're not the only one suffering. And in essence, Peter's saying, I'm one of them. I have a story too. And I love that as we go to the Gospel of John, and I'd ask you to go with me to John chapter 13, we're going to see Peter's story here. The story of Peter's fall and rise. Now, this is not a trick question. Who's telling the story in John? John. It's his gospel account. John is no mere distant student of Peter. John was part of the inner three with Peter. That inner circle that got to attend some scenes in the New Testament that the other nine disciples were not invited to. And they got to hear Jesus say some things that the others didn't. And they saw power from Christ that others didn't in different private scenes. John was there with Peter. John knew Peter very well. Not just as a fellow apostle, not just as a colleague, but as a friend. He knew him very well. And as John puts his pen to paper, so to speak, to write his gospel account, Peter had been martyred for 15 or 20 years before this. By the time John's writing, Peter had been gone maybe 10 or 2 decades in the presence of Christ. He was martyred. It was a triumphant martyrdom, but it was real. And the life of Peter before his martyrdom was real. And John knew Peter probably better than most anyone. And it's interesting. John was there to see Peter's fall. If we understand the gospel accounts, John was the only other disciple of the 12 that was there to see it and to hear it in that courtyard. John saw the fall firsthand, but John also was witness to the rise. So I'm glad it's John telling us Peter's story. And let me just say this to you. This morning at this retreat, this weekend, you need to see Peter's fall. And you need to see Peter's rise. Lest you come to the wilds this weekend and leave wondering if you are doomed to usefulness or uselessness in your Christian life because of your failures. And perhaps you've not driven up this mountain, so to speak, this weekend. You've limped up here. You want to be used. You want to be engaged in heartfelt, affection-driven worship and living. But you're not quite sure you're useful anymore. You need to see Peter's fall and his rise. You know, Peter would one day write these words in 1 Peter 1:7, "The proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." It was Peter who heard Jesus say to him in Luke 22:32, "I've prayed for you." It's Peter who is exhibit A of what it means to fall and what it means to rise to usefulness again. I want you to track with me in the study right now his fall and his rise. And I want to hang my thoughts on 5 R's that will be easy to track with. 5 R's as we track with him and hear this story from John about his good friend. The first one is resolve. We start here with resolve. Now, I'm not saying that it's not good to have resolve and to make promises and to be committed. And I'm not saying that's wrong at all. I remember my son plays on a basketball team in the Hampton Roads area. It's like a homeschool enrichment program where you have all these homeschool, high school families, and they send their kids to the central location once or twice a week, and you have people that are degreed in biology or Spanish or literature teaching high school courses and offering labs. And you know the setup. And this co-op puts together a basketball team, a varsity basketball team. And for some reason, we're pretty good. I mean, we're playing in the state tournament actually last night and today for Virginia. It's a good team. You have some 6'4" guys on the team. You have some guys with some skill. But it's not only are they a good team, but they're a close-knit team. I remember last year or 2 years ago, the basketball season wrapped up with a basketball tournament in Lynchburg. And then the season was over in March. And the guys didn't want to stop being athletic together. Basketball was over. What are we going to do now? Well, in Virginia Beach was a huge field house with just a ton of things to do and different sports leagues. And the basketball guys said, let's enter our basketball team into the flag football league, where we're going to be playing against other high schoolers. And now this is not a controlled league. This is going to be a secular league. And you got these Christian guys wanting just to stay together and be active together. So they were the homeschool flag football team. Well, when the word got out that they were homeschool, they started getting a lot of grief. But the grief kind of went away because they were crushing all the teams in football. They were very athletic, tall. And they started. Well, there was one public school team. We didn't know this, but their starting quarterback and some of their starters, in order to keep their football skills active in the spring, they entered this league as well. Ocean Lakes High School. It was a public school. They had a great football team. There were several colleges looking at their quarterback. They entered this league too, and they kind of were in the far side of the league. And when we played each other early in the season, they beat us, but by just a little bit. But while they were beating us, you know, they were cursing us. They were taking cheap hits, and we had to keep reminding them flag football, not tackle. And so it was a real test. But they were frustrated because they found out these were homeschoolers, and that it was even a close game was an insult to them. So they're cursing us. They're playing dirty, and they beat us by just a little bit. Well, we weren't scheduled to play them anymore that season until the end of the season when there was a tournament. And when they started to see that they were winning and we were winning easily in our wing, they were starting to see that we were going to face each other in the championship game again. Well, our guys were like, oh, this will be fun. I mean, our guys don't know any better. They're just Christians out trying to be active, you know, having a good time. But this public school team, they were getting all worked up and they were bringing their friends out to the game and they're just ready to just have a pep rally to beat these homeschool kids. And they came in and they were talking trash before the game. They were talking trash during the game. But our guys played the game of their life, especially on defense. And you have this all-star quarterback couldn't hit his guys because our forwards from our basketball team were blocking it or intercepting it. I kid you not, it was like the last minute and a half, 2 minutes of the game. We were just down by less than a touchdown. And one of our guys, our shooting guard, intercepted a pass. He was very quick, and he ran it all the way back for a touchdown. We won the game. I mean, these guys were beside themselves. I literally had to step between the parents of a guy on our team. He wasn't from our church. A guy from our team and a father from the other team, and he wasn't in any church, okay? And they were sizing each other to fight. And so I stepped in the middle and, you know, started talking about the weather and just trying to calm things down. I mean, it was, these guys walked in, we're going to crush these homeschool kids, but man, did they fall far. You know, Peter is one that expressed his commitment, his resolve, loud and clear. We've seen that. And we've been warned, by the way, by Proverbs 26, that many a man proclaims his own loyalty, but who can find a trustworthy man? I see here in John 13 that Peter's resolve is very obvious for three reasons. First of all, Peter even investigated the loyalty of others. He was constantly snooping around. All right, who's up for the fight here? Who's in, man? Look at John 13, verses 21 to 26. And when Jesus had said this, he became troubled in spirit. And he testified and said, "Truly, truly, I say to you that one of you will betray me." We're in the upper room here. And the disciples began looking at one another at a loss to know of which one he was speaking. And there was reclining at Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Who is that? It's John. It's the one telling the story. And look at verse 24. We're not surprised. So Simon Peter gestured to him and said to him, "Tell us, who is it of whom he is speaking?" Peter's like, "What do you mean someone's going to betray our team and our Lord? John, you're close. Find out who that is. I want to know." He investigated the loyalty of others. He had little time for someone who wouldn't stay in the fight. But secondly, he reveals his resolve because he elevated himself above others. He elevated himself above others. Stay here in John 13, and again, look at verse 31. "Therefore, when he had gone out, Jesus said, 'Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and will glorify him immediately.'" And then verse 34, he's talking about the new commandment of love. Look at verse 36, though. "Simon Peter said to him, 'Lord, where are you going?' And Jesus answered, 'Where I go, you can't come now. Oh, you can't follow me now, Peter, but you will follow later.' Peter said to him, 'Lord, why am I not to follow you right now? I will lay down my life for you.'" He says, I don't know about the rest of these guys, but I'm with you to the end. I'm willing to have everything go dark and enter eternity for your sake. I don't know what these other guys are going to do. But as for me, I'm elevating myself above them as far as commitment." That's quite a resolve. But there's a third way I see his resolve here. He engaged the enemy before others. Okay? He investigated the loyalty of others. He elevated himself above others. And he even engaged the enemy before others. And that again is in John 18, 1 through 11. We saw that in our morning session. I mean, the bad guys come in. Peter's the one with the sword. He starts swinging for the heads. Only one. That's resolve. But you know, you and I have learned something since our childhood, haven't we? The higher you climb in that tree, the farther you, what? Fall. The greater the visibility, the greater the devastation. So the first R is resolve. But then we come to the second R. And this is the lowest point. It's remorse. Remorse. I'd like for you to go with me to John chapter 18 for this. The one who was checking out everyone else's loyalty and making promises beyond everyone else. And even the one who drew the sword. We're not expecting to find that same guy now in this paragraph. John 18. Let's start in verse 15. "And Simon Peter was following Jesus, so was another disciple." Who's that? That's John. He's the one telling the story. "Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in." Peter's close to John. Whatever's going to happen with Peter, John's right there. Verse 17, "Then the slave girl who kept the door said to Peter, 'You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?' And he said, 'I am not.' Now the slaves and the officers were standing there, having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold, and they were warming themselves. And Peter was also with them, standing and warming himself." And then we have the account there in verse 19 of the high priest questioning Jesus and Jesus being struck. And then it ends at verse 24, "Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest." And we pick up with Peter again in verse 25. Look at this. "Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, 'You are not also one of his disciples, are you?' And he denied it and said, 'I am not.' And one of the slaves of the high priest being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, oops, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" And Peter then denied it again, and immediately the rooster crowed. Now, if you compare this account with the other gospel accounts, you go to Matthew 26, verse 75, we read some new information. It says, after this, Peter wept, how? Bitterly. If you go to Mark chapter 14, verse 72, Mark mentions the tears. If you go to Luke 22, 62, Luke mentions the tears. I have a question for you, Peter. What's causing the tears? Why the tears? And perhaps if we could interview him, in light of what we have in the text here, he would answer with these three answers. Here's what's behind my remorse. First of all, it was the echo of my shallow resolve. The echo of my shallow resolve. I mean, I'm the one that said, I'll be the last one to deny you, and I was the first one to deny him. What else caused your tears, Peter? Well, the smallness of my failed test. What do you mean by that? Well, the text here and in the other Gospels points out it was just a little servant girl asking a question. And Peter goes off. Just a little girl. Didn't take much, Peter, to tip you over, did it? What else caused your tears, Peter? Well, he might answer with this third answer. It was the look of my denied Lord. See, Luke gives us some information here at this point. In Luke 22:61, Dr. Luke writes, "The Lord turned at this point and looked at Peter. And Peter then remembered the word of the Lord and how he had told him, 'Before a rooster crows today, you will deny me three times.'" It was that look. You know, Peter would one day write these words in 1 Peter 5:5. "All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another." And he's going to quote Proverbs 3 here. "For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble." Paraphrase, God humbles the proud and graces the humble. Mr. Resolve was brought low out of love by his Lord. God himself humbled him, and how he did. There's this great remorse. But I need to remind you about something this morning. Peter's fall was not final. If you missed that one, definitely hear this one. Your fall is not final as a believer. I love Proverbs 24:16. "For a righteous man falls seven times and rises," how many more? He just gets up again. He rises again. "But the wicked stumble in time of calamity." This brings us to the third R as we track this story of his rise, his fall and rise. The third R is reconciliation. Reconciliation. Now, I need you to notice something here in the text. We're going to have reconciliation here in a moment. We're going to see it. But I want to ask this question. Who initiates this reconciliation? Who's the one that pursues the other one? My first observation as I answer that is this. It wasn't Peter. See, well, how do you know that? Well, we know that Peter ran to the tomb, but there was no one there with which to be reconciled. The tomb was empty. And we know this in John chapter 20. Look over at John. Let's hear the text in this. Verse 1, "Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb while it was still dark and saw the stone already taken away from the tomb. So she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple," which is John, "whom Jesus loved, and said to them, 'They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have laid him.' So Peter and the other disciple went forth, and they were going to the tomb, and the two were running together. And the other disciple ran faster than Peter and came to the tomb first. And stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. And so Simon Peter also came, and following him, even entered into the tomb. And he saw the linen wrappings lying there, and the face cloth which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. So the other disciple who had first come to the tomb then also entered, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. And look at verse 10. So the disciples, who we're talking about, John and Peter, went away again to their homes. There was no reconciliation in that tomb. Jesus wasn't there. So Peter is not the one who initiated this reconciliation, ultimately. So my second observation is this. Who did then? I want to argue with you that the one who initiated this reconciliation with Peter was the one most offended. It was Christ. Christ pursued Peter. So where do you get this? I'd like for you to hold your finger here in John and go with me to Luke chapter 24, verse 34. I'm going to show you this text and one other text. Luke chapter 24 and verse 34. You have the two men on the road to Emmaus. Remember this? And Christ manifested himself to them. They didn't recognize him at first, but it wasn't until he broke bread and then they saw who he was, and then he vanished out of their sight, and they were going back to the disciples to tell them that Jesus was alive. Verse 33, and they got up that very hour and returned to Jerusalem and found gathered together the 11 and those who were with them, saying, "The Lord has really risen and has appeared to Simon." What's happened here? He's alive, and the word has already gotten out, and he's already found Peter. There's a private meeting? Mm-hmm. See, where do you get this? Well, I'd like for you to look quickly at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the great resurrection chapter. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And remember what you have learned in verses 3 through 8 here. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to who? Cephas, Peter, then to the 12. And after that, he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now. I mean, the early church knew that in all probability, the first person that had a private audience with the resurrected Christ was Peter. Who's initiating this reconciliation? It's Christ. You know, at some time in the past 3 years during Christ's earthly ministry, Peter had heard Jesus teach what's in Matthew 18. That when a childlike disciple goes off into sin, Jesus says, "I'm like the shepherd that will leave all the sheep and go pursue the one who's off in sin. And when I find him, there's great rejoicing." Peter had heard that taught by Jesus. Peter's now living it. He's the lamb. Here comes the shepherd. No wonder Peter would one day pen these words in 1 Peter 2:25. "You were continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and the guardian of your souls." That's awesome. This is real reconciliation. And you know one thing I learned from your pastor teacher years ago in college, in counseling class. I learned from him that reconciliation always creates a stronger relationship than prior to the offense. And that brings us to the fourth R, restoration. Restoration. We'll spend the rest of our time in John chapter 21. A text that we know we come to often. We can quote most of it. John chapter 21. Let me read verses 1 through 11 and make these points. After these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and he manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter and Thomas, called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana of Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee and two others of the disciples were together. And Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." And they said to him, "We will also come with you." He's a leader. And they went out and got into the boat. And that night they caught how much again? At this point, he should be getting nervous. He knows, as a fisherman, that at that time of the night, where they were fishing, they should have taken a good catch. He knows this trade. And when they pulled up nothing all night at that spot, he should have been nervous already. Verse 4, but when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, Children, you do not have any fish, do you? I think Jesus might have grinned there. And they answered him, no. And he said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat and you will find a catch. This is the second point. Peter should have been nervous. So they cast and they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. What difference does one side of the boat mean over the other side of the boat? Verse 7, therefore the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, guess what? It's the Lord. So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he had stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. And look at this, verse 9. So when they got out of the on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish which you have now caught. And Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Wow. We know, as we compare the gospel accounts, that this is the fourth or the fifth resurrection appearance that we know of. And Peter was present in all of these. I mean, we've already seen that probably the first appearance was Peter. And then we also find in chapter 20, verses 19 and 26, that there were two more appearances of Christ to the gathered disciples. You had the guys on the road to Emmaus. So this is probably the fifth appearance. And I'm struck at this tender scene, at this fire on the seashore. This text is debated by many. A lot of commentators have written on this. A lot of trees have died to create the paper for this debate. What's the difference between agape and phileo? And you've heard sermons on that. And I think it's an important matter to wrestle with. But there are two realities I can't miss about this restoration that's happening. First of all, there's the renewal of construction work. There's renewal of construction because these disciples are now eating breakfast with Jesus. And in the midst of all this, Jesus once again singles out Peter in front of the others and goes back to work on him. You see that in verse 15. So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, just like old times, Simon, you're the leader. I'm going to single you out one more time in front of the other guys, and I'm going back to work on you. I'm not failing you. I'm not forsaking you. I've pursued you in reconciliation. I manifested in private company my resurrection body to you. We're still in this, Peter. And I'm picking up where I left off with you. Even after a fall that went so low, let's get back to work. There's a renewal of the construction. But I'm also struck with this. There's a reaffirmation of resolve. A reaffirmation of resolve. How many times did Peter deny Jesus that night? How many times? Three. How many times is he going to be able to respond to Jesus and tell Jesus in front of the other disciples in this text how committed he is to him? How many times? Three. Let's read it. Verse 15. Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? I don't think he's talking about the fish. Some people do. You like me more than fishing? You want to go back to your old trade? I don't think that's what we're talking about here. I think he's saying, Peter, you told me you were more loyal than these other disciples. Do you really agape me more than all of these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. And he said to him, tend my lambs. And he said to him again a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Same question. He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. And he said to him, shepherd my sheep. And he said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved. He says, do you phileo me? Now Jesus is using Peter's words. And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "All right, tend my sheep. Tend my sheep." What is this? This is an opportunity in front of the other disciples who would have heard of this denial. It's an opportunity for Peter to express, to reaffirm his resolve in realistic terms this time. In realistic terms. Peter's a little hesitant to take that top word anymore because he failed him so seriously, but he knows he still is loyal to him. And he's going to use the word phileo to describe his commitment. Because if you tell the truth there, there's still room to increase your commitment towards agape. My dad used to tell me as a businessman, he said, "Son, if you tell everyone your company's number one, there's only one way for you to go. Which way is that? Down." He says, "Be a strong two and face number one and keep pushing." And that was good business advice from my dad. But I'm telling you, it's a great spiritual principle here. Peter's saying, "Oh, I'm in, Lord. I'm in. I know now I'm fragile, but I'm in. And I want more." Peter would one day write this in 1 Peter 3 and in 1 Peter 5. "Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. And after you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to His eternal glory in Christ, will Himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you." It's going to be Christ that's going to put the air into the tires of your resolve. This is restoration. If restoration is the "on your mark, get set" thing, then the final R is the go, and it's recommission. Recommission. Let me give you this fact. You know this fact. A growing Christian is a moving Christian. He's on the go. A moving Christian won't sit still. She's not going to blend in. The wheels are spinning, waiting to hit the pavement again. And again, in front of the other disciples, Jesus recommissions this disciple that outside of Jude had the farthest fall in our mind. What does he say? He says three times, "These are my lambs, my sheep, my sheep." He told Peter to get moving specifically, first of all, "Remember your stewardship. You're busy with lambs. You're busy with sheep. But just keep something in mind. They're not yours, Peter. They're mine. Everything you handle in my service doesn't belong to you." Kind of sounds like what Paul said to the elders from Ephesus. He said, "Shepherd the sheep over which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers." Or Peter himself will write in his epistle, in chapter 5, I think it's verse 1 or 2, "Shepherd the flock of God." It's not Peter's. So Peter, remember, as you're busy, what you're handling isn't yours, it's mine. Remember your stewardship. These are my sheep, my lambs. But secondly, he says, "And take the initiative. You tend them. You feed them. You pursue them. They're not yours, but Peter, you got to take the initiative. Get moving." Peter went after sheep. He realized these sheep weren't his. He pursued them. Actually, in Acts chapter 2, on the day of Pentecost, Peter will even be gathering the sheep in. Peter, the one who had fallen so low, was used greatly. And the church is born in Acts. Now this morning, you've watched Peter's fall. And you've watched him rise. I wonder where you are as you look at simple R's. Are you caught in your initial resolve now that is sounding more like a superhero resolve than someone who's familiar with their being so fragile with their faith? Perhaps you find yourself in remorse now because you, in your mind, are good for nothing. You've fallen too far or too many times now. And you walk with a limp in your Christian life. Sure, you can smile. Sure, you use the right translations and you read the right books and you go to the good church and you're doing everything. But deep inside, you feel like you're rowing your boat in shallow water with lots of seaweed and your anchor is dropped. That's your Christian feel. Because of your sin, because of your failures. I mean, if that's you, you need to understand that Jesus is pursuing you. The one you fear that you've offended the most is the one who's doing the most to be reconciled to you. Figure that out. You say, well, other people know how far I've fallen. Well, then the other people are going to see your restoration. And they're going to hear your recommission. You're back in this, man. As a Christian, you're not done. You're not unusable. You're not discarded. You've grown. Don't look now, but your shepherd is coming for you.